Hello, this is Sean Kennedy. I'm the editor-in-chief of the American Journal of Nursing, and I'm very pleased to have on the phone with me today Marilyn Orman and Joe Haig. Marilyn is the professor and adult geriatric health chair at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill School of Nursing in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And Joe Haig is the director of global training for ECC, which is the Emergency Cardiovascular Care for the American Heart Association. And Marilyn co-authored an article in the May issue of AJN with colleagues Suzanne Cardoz-Edgren and Tamara Odom. Go ahead, Marilyn.
Marilyn.
At Washington State University College of Nursing in Spokane. The article, Competence in CPR, discusses findings from research Marilyn conducted on CPR training and skill retention among nursing students. We felt that the findings had significant implications for nurses in practice, especially in light of changes that occurred in the CPR guidelines in the fall of 2010. So we did ask Marilyn to develop a paper, and we're also happy to have Joe from the American Heart Association with us to talk about the implications for guidelines. So Marilyn, would you give us a brief overview of the research you did among students that led to this article?
Yes, this was a really interesting study we did. We had more than 600 students, and it was a randomized controlled trial, and we initially randomized the students into training for CPR, either using the American Heart Association's Heart Code course, which is self-directed and computer-based, or students had a traditional instructor-led training, where it's face-to-face for about a half a day with their instructor. All students then, once they passed their BLS course and were certified, were then randomly assigned another time. So we made sure that all the students were trained in CPR at a baseline. When we did our second randomization, some of the students went into a control group. The control group had no further practice of CPR for one full year. And I think about that control group being comparable to the way we teach a lot of skills in nursing. You learn the skill, you're passed, you're checked off, but you never really practice it again. Mm-hmm. In the experimental group, though, students practice their CPR on voice-activated mannequins that really guide their practice. So the mannequin would say, you need to compress deeper, you need to compress more rapidly. So those students in the experimental group, every month, for 6 minutes, that's all it took, went to the learning lab and they practiced their CPR. And it almost is common sense to me, if you practice, you learn to perform more proficiently. And those students in the experimental group not only maintained their skill in CPR, but they actually got better as the year went on. But in the control group, where students had no practice beyond their initial training, by 3 months, they were no longer able to ventilate correctly. And by 9 months, they were no longer able to compress. They just didn't remember that skill.
Wow. Now, Joe, the compressions became much more prominent in the new guidelines, correct?
Yes, they did.
And the whole ABC has been turned around a bit to CAB.
Right, because of the importance of compressions and really want to emphasize in getting compressions started as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm. And how deep are the compressions ideally?
That changed with guidelines as well. In the past, we taught people to look at 1.5 to 2 inches of compression depth on an adult, and now the guidelines say at least 2 inches. May not seem like a lot, but we're finding in you know, just random feedback that we're getting verbally from people, and in some of the people that are using Heart Code regularly, they are having a lot of problems getting to that, adding that additional half inch to meet the defined standard.
And Sean and Joe, this is the thing that's interesting about our study. Our study ended around the time that the new guidelines were introduced. And we collected the data electronically, so it wasn't that we had to observe the student doing the compressions and measure the depth. It was actually done by the computer, so we had this electronic data. We went back to see how deep were students compressing, we found that only 4% of this entire group of students certified in BLS, 24 students, were able to compress to meet the new guidelines.
That's really
striking. So that's pretty striking.
That has such significant implications for practice. I'm thinking of most institutions and staff development departments where once a year they call out, you know, a recessi ante, and it, most, I would bet, don't have the more sophisticated voice-activated mannequins. And, you know, they provide coffee and snacks, and people come down and do a quick, you know, practice and get their certification. And this certainly has implications for how they should be training in hospitals.
The scary thing is that in many places it's not even every year. Our recognition up from our card is 2 years. And in many places, that's how often people come down and go down or find a class to do their mannequin practice.
And we could see from our study with students who are, you know, a pretty good group to study because they don't have these years of experience to kind of rest on what they think they know. Well, we could see in 3 to 6 months you start losing your skill. So I don't think it's any different for RNs working in a med-surg unit, in a clinic, in a non-ICU setting where you really don't get to practice your CPR.
Right. And even having been and worked in ICUs and ERs, even then, you may go months without having to do CPR. So I would say, I would venture to say most nurses in those types of units as well are not really doing it enough to keep up skills.
Mm-hmm.
And I was amazed that it was 6 minutes a month was what seemed sufficient.
Well, and the only thing, what we've said is, I say that with caution because we, in the design of the study, we put in 6 minutes a month, but I don't know if you really even need that much. It could be for an RN who's been trained a couple of times, maybe just once every 6 months is all it would take, or once every 3 months. I think somebody needs to look at what practice is essential for a person who's had some repeated training. But 6 minutes is not very long to do it. I mean, everybody has 6 minutes a month in their practice setting.
Right.
If you make it convenient.
Now, one question that came to mind is when I think of the times I did my CPR training, I would go and the instructor would watch your technique and then make maybe a couple corrections here or there. But it was the instructor just eyeballing what you were doing that was sufficient, but yet with the focus and emphasis on compressions first and the need to get to 2 inches, I wonder if the instructor observation is really the best way to go about this.
Hi,
Joe, I'm sorry, go ahead, Joe.
You know, bottom line is no, it's probably not, because it is a an objective judgment of watching and looking. Some mannequins give some clicking noises when they reach a certain depth, but having the true feedback that you can go back and look at and evaluate with the student is a better learning process.
Mm-hmm. And I was just going to mention, when we did our review of the literature, we found a new study by Lynch and colleagues, and they actually did comparisons of instructors teaching CPR and making judgments of ventilation and compression depths. And then the mannequin, you know, or more at electronic feedback, and they found that instructors' rating of ventilation skills was highly accurate, but that instructors typically were not able to judge compression depth.
Hmm.
Because you're just looking at it.
Well, that's what occurred to me as I was reading and thinking of well, how do you know really if the student or trainee is really getting that depth, and if the instructor is eyeballing it and reinforcing, okay, your technique is good, when in fact they're not getting the depth, that's, you know, they're reinforcing the incorrect depth of compression. So in thinking about the best way to really observe people and make sure that trainees or students are performing the technique correctly, it seems that observation by an instructor may not be the best way to go about this. Marilyn, from your study using the voice-activated mannequins, it seems that that would be a much more scientific and evidence-based way to prove that someone is really achieving the depth of compression.
I think it was. It's easier for the student, and probably would be for the RN, to hear some prompting for if you're not going deep enough, you're not going fast enough. And I know that when we finished our study, there was a couple reports of, instead of voice activated, they're mannequins that have a screen where you can visually see with a bar going up and down, which I actually think would be better. So you can look at this as you compress, you can see this bar moving up and down to show how deep you are. So I think those kinds of techniques are probably better than just the teacher trying to eyeball the depth.
Right.
And I might have even mentioned earlier that a study by Lynch and colleagues found that instructors of CPR, when they rated ventilation skills, they were accurate, but when they were asked to judge compression depth, they were not as accurate. And less than 50% were correct when they said that the depth was deep enough. So it could be that when people are learning CPR, they think they're compressing deep enough, but they maybe aren't. So now with these new guidelines where you have to go 2 inches, they just don't sense that what they had learned before maybe wasn't adequate.
And they're getting reinforcement of a bad technique in those.
Perhaps, things. Yep.
Now, also on the call, who joined us, is Mary Fran Hazinski, who's a professor in the Vanderbilt School of Nursing and a clinical nurse specialist at the Children's Hospital of Vanderbilt, and also senior science editor at the American Heart Association. Welcome, Mary Fran. I'm glad you're able to join us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So in listening to the conversation, and you're still very much into the practice setting, what do you see as perhaps changing based on the new guidelines and some of the this information and research coming out now that people aren't achieving the compressions?
Well, the new guidelines calling for deeper compressions really will be challenging to achieve if people have not practiced and they're not aware of how difficult it is. And so we know that folks that are coming in for re-credentialing are in for a little bit of a challenge. We also know that the typical method of credentialing rescuers, having, for example, nurses and physicians and other healthcare providers come into a setting and be credentialed once a year, is just inadequate to ensure that the CPR skills are maintained. And so studies such as this one are excellent in documenting the need for frequent retraining and frequent practice. And using calibrated mannequins, instrumented mannequins with feedback devices or defibrillators that can give you feedback about depth of compression and frequency of ventilation and adequacy of ventilation and compression can help really make sure that people are learning the motor skills and developing almost that muscle memory mm-hmm. of adequate compressions and appropriate ventilation.
So Mary Fran and Joe, do you see the any changes coming on the frequency which the AHA requires recertification in BLS or ACLS?
Well, in the 2010 guidelines, the evidence evaluation process documented that skill degradation occurs in as early as 6 weeks after training. So there's a growing body of evidence that annual credentialing is inadequate. But because we did not have sufficient evidence identifying the ideal retraining interval, we did not make specific recommendations in 2010 to change, but did encourage the frequent retraining and frequent opportunities for retraining. And as we get more and more evidence from studies such as this beautiful one that will help us identify intervals and types of training and duration of training, we hope to then be able to come up with some recommendations that will be evidence-based.
Mm-hmm.
Did you want to comment?
You know, I agree with you. Right now, it's still a two-year recognition when anybody comes to a class and gets their standard card. But definitely agree with Mary Fran. And we're looking at what are some options that come out of, suggestions and recommendations out of the study as far as frequency and the importance of doing some of those psychomotor skills much more often, but in very little short doses, if you would.
Right. Now, Marilyn, what's your feeling in terms of further research that if after doing all this work with students and now knowing what you know about degradation of skills and what time you've followed the students and the frequency of retraining, what would you like to look at next? What question did it leave in your mind? What burning question that, oh, I wish I had done this, what I want to do next?
Mm-hmm. Well, I have two questions. One would be for, the practice side. I mean, I think somebody, I think Mary Fran articulated it well. I don't think we know how frequent should these short practices be. And as I mentioned earlier, we had monthly practice, but it could be for an RN once every 6 months is all it takes. Mm-hmm. And I know that there was this really interesting study, Rolling Refreshers, where they brought the CPR mannequin right to the unit at lunch break, and people then, when they were done with their lunch, they practiced for 5 minutes. Something like that would work pretty well, I think, in a clinical setting. So I'd like to see those studies. But in terms of nursing ed, in terms of staff development, teaching skills, I think we need to look at the skills we're teaching and are we providing enough practice. I think we teach a lot of skills that people will never use in practice, and if they don't then use those or practice those, it's probably not worth the instruction time in the beginning.
So it's that use it or lose it.
It's that, yes, or you have to say to yourself, is it really worth teaching it? We found this wonderful meta-analysis, and I think it was out of physical education. The author's name was Arthur, A-R-T-H-U-R, and they looked at, I think, 53 different studies on practice and skill learning, and they found if you learn a skill and you're assessed, and you meet this initial competency, the way we do like in foundations and fundamentals, you get checked off. But if you don't practice your skill in 1 year, you only retain 8% of the skill level. I think that has implications for staff development, for
many,
orientation programs.
And for many skills. I mean, we're focusing on CPR, of course, but when you think of all the other skills that nurses need to know, this is opening a big can of worms.
Right.
Well, and there probably is, it's Mary Fran, there probably is a big difference between the types of refreshers needed by those who perform resuscitation on a frequent basis and those who rarely perform resuscitation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
I know at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, they have an instrumented mannequin in a room right in their pediatric critical care unit, and they try and perform just-in-time training where the attending physicians and the nurses on a given day will identify the patient most likely to arrest, and they will try and get that nurse and physician away from the bedside for a few minutes to just practice response to the most likely type of arrest that patient will demonstrate, just to make sure that the team is ready to perform. Mm-hmm. And yet we would want to do entirely different refreshers out on a floor or in a clinic setting where resuscitation should, rightly, rarely be performed. Those providers would likely have to do more detailed refresher from beginning because they won't encounter a patient in arrest and shouldn't encounter a patient in arrest very often if they're detecting patients who are sick and getting them transferred sufficiently rapidly.
Right, and that's where this makes a case for rapid response teams where one would think the members who are, many of the nurses work in critical care units or emergency areas and then respond to the med-surg units, that they would have more training and more practice. So it does kind of make a case to getting the rapid response people involved as early as possible.
Well, and we know now that an arrest on the floor, and especially a respiratory arrest on the floor, is considered a sentinel event. It's a real marker of an event that indicates that there has been some failure in the system if a patient has to deteriorate to mm-hmm. the point of before detection. But we do know that there will be some sudden arrhythmic arrests. There will be arrests that staff have to attend in a clinic or in a cafeteria, and it's critically important that all staff be prepared to respond with good resuscitation skills. And so identifying the best types of practice that will be both efficient and effective, efficient from a time and and even a financial commitment from the system, from the institution, and effective in helping maintain skills will be critical. So studies such as Dr. Orman's are just terrific and help us identify some frequency numbers that can be supported by data, and also the time involved. As little as 6 minutes of practice on a regular basis really is very effective.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you all for participating in this call. I hope the readers, the listeners, got some good points from this, the takeaway being that frequent, and it can be short, but frequent training and frequent practice, rather, is necessary to maintain certainly CPR skills, but for staff development people, it's really perhaps a little bit of a wake-up call that we really need to look at the other essential skills that staff need to perform on emergent basis, perhaps, and revisit how we train them. So I want to thank you all very much for participating.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.